Hi, and welcome to the first episode of Season 7 of Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wortsman, and I'm sort of here, sort of not here, with my co-host Laura Chan Baker.
Hello. Oh, wait. Hola.
Hello. Hola.
Nailed it.
I felt really terrible saying that. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. This season, as Laura eats her way around Mexico, the two of us are coming together via the wonders of the internet to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs. We'll be discussing some words of warning for freelancers and how to get an illustration agent. Laura, first things first, oh my God, we're doing this remotely. I'm here in Melbourne, luxuriating in the hot box. My arms are wide.
Your own personal hot box.
Yes, exactly. I feel free, but no, I still feel very close to you. I'm really excited that we're doing this season together still.
I find it very funny that I'm the one in Mexico, yet you're the one who couldn't get the internet working this morning.
This is very true. This is, well, as the amazing photos from your trip showcase. And can you maybe just read what was the shirt from Cancun that you posted?
Oh, God. It was like, keep calm. You're on the fun side of Trump's wall or something like that.
And I guess you are, because you've got
you
fantastic
Don't worry.
Internet.
I'm in Mexico City now. I'm at my uncle's law firm in his office, but most people have kind of gone home for the day. Things seem pretty happy over here in Mexico.
Amazing. And yeah, we have been following your journey mostly in a gastronomic way. So what is the best thing that you have eaten this week? Because there have been many, many things.
Holy shit. Yeah. Anyone who follows me on Instagram, the food has been out of control. It's really hard to pick the best thing. I think this week it's been, we went to the most beautiful little town. It's called Bacalar. It's on the Yucatan coast. And it sits on this like huge, stunning lagoon. And so there's heaps of fresh seafood. And we ate some fish that was prepared in this like very traditional Mayan way called tikinchik. And basically like the whole fish is marinated in this echiote adobo with sour oranges. And it's like wrapped in banana leaf and cooked sort of in an earth oven beneath a wood fire. And it's just like outrageously delicious. And it was like, I don't know, like $7 Australian for the whole fish. And we ate it sitting by the water with some margaritas in hand. It was pretty spot on.
And when does your Netflix show come out that kind of follows you on your journeys?
Okay, you joke, but that would be my dream job, getting paid to eat and travel. Oh my God. And people just listening to me talk. What a dream.
Well, now that you are freed from the shackles of Jackie Winter, anything is possible. But even though
finally
you are freed from those shackles, we are still doing this new season together. And it's going to be, we're taking a bit of a different approach. We're going to be making things shorter because I think we both really, really like talking. And also, yeah, we're trying to kind of,
you don't say.
We're trying to figure out, I guess, just more of a streamlined way to kind of approach this and heard kind of what you like and what you want to hear less of and what you hear more of. And I think, yeah, the overall consensus is that, you know, we could not let you go. So we're so happy that you've joined us and we're going to get stuck straight into it. I'm going to go with...
I'm still shackled.
You are still shackled in an emotional way.
One shackle on, one shackle off.
Well, let's get things started. I will start with my link for the week. Actually, we've had a bit of a 4 to 5 kind of week break, so lots of kind of things banking up, and we're going to do a bit of a kind of review of our open tabs and a new feature that we'll be closing the show with in addition to thumbs up, thumbs down, shaka. But anyway, getting stuck straight into it. My link of the past few weeks is titled, it's actually a multi-part link titled How to Get an Illustration Agent. And again, it's so fresh. It's not even finished yet. So at the moment, we've only got the first two parts. Again, it's titled How to Get an Illustration Agent, and it pretty much does what it says on the label. And the piece is written by Tom Froese. Apologies if I'm butchering any surnames, as always. Tom's an award-winning illustrator, designer in Vancouver, and it was posted on a blog called Illustration Age. And this blog actually was started by another illustrator named Thomas James. It's been going for, I think, maybe close to a decade. Yeah, we kind of caught up with Thomas like in the very early days of Jackie Winter when we were kind of in the UK for a kind of trade show that we were on his earlier podcast called Escape from Illustration Island. And yeah, some really great stuff there. But yeah, Illustration Age is, you know, it's a great resource. And look, as illustration agents ourselves, I think we know a bit about what it takes to get representation. But as I'm frequently telling people, just a tiny bit, I'm often telling people who ask us, the advice that I give is always going to be specific to representation with Jackie Winter, as any kind of artistic representation, whether it's literary, performative, et cetera, it's a real kind of long-term relationship. And a lot of the complexities and idiosyncrasies that are in any kind of relationship, romantic, personal, business, whatever, and they all exist there. And there's really no one-size-fits-all approach. So I'm really keen to read articles like this and see how other people approach the issue, as it's literally the most frequent question that we are asked in our role as agents. This is of interest not only so I can absorb and pass on the information in my own way, but also we actually often encourage our own artists to seek out new representation frequently in certain circumstances. Now, I know that might seem surprising to hear, but the fact is some of our most successful artists are the ones that had the most representation. So whenever I'm talking to an artist about their long-term plans, I always ask how they're approaching expanding the representation in other territories. For us, for example, we don't speak French, we don't speak Japanese, we don't have offices there or know the market intimately. Both countries have robust illustration industries and some great agencies, and it wouldn't be fair for us to assume exclusivity in those regions if we are not actively, you know, active there. So it only seems fair that our artists should explore relationships there independently. And that kind of segues nicely into the first piece of advice in this article series, which is, and he kind of breaks these down to different paragraphs. And the first one he goes into is saying, study agencies to find the best fit. And Tom starts off by stating, and I quote, "This seems obvious, but many people overlook this step. As an illustrator with a unique voice and a unique taste, you want to align yourself with an agency that seems to match. Similarly, agencies typically have their own taste in illustration, and they will be attracted to illustrators who would fit in and look good on their roster." Now, I like that he leads to this point because I agree that it's truly one of the most crucial steps. Currently, there are probably a few hundred agencies out there at the moment, with more seemingly popping up every few months. And to survive in a growing market, each agency has its own point of difference. So understanding how you fit in is really crucial. Now, for us, I always say that it can kind of go two ways. So, I mean, sometimes we just get a lot of kind of work references kind of coming in, and we find that, okay, this kind of niche isn't there that with someone on our books that we can kind of look at. So we go out and we try to kind of find that. And I think in many ways, that's how the agency has grown organically over the past kind of 12 years. And sometimes randomly by chance, something comes in through a submission channel that we actually kind of look at seriously and then kind of go from there. But I would actually say that's at the state that we're at, it happens less and less now. But, you know, at the moment, we're definitely kind of searching more, but the chance of your work seeing through an actual submission channel can improve tenfold by writing a decent email that considers kind of where you kind of see yourself and actually following the submission guidelines. And those submission guidelines are different for every agency, but we write them so it works with our workflow because we want to kind of look at work. So most agents, of course, are really busy people, but our businesses depend on representing amazing artists. So everyone's work will be seen kind of if you send it properly, according to how it kind of needs to be sent. But most of the time, I kind of think that people who are kind of, you know, working and putting their work out there, it will be kind of seen if you're kind of doing the right thing. And they go on to more of that in the second part of the article. But anyway, yes, I reckon you could probably write a whole piece on just this point alone. But the first part of the article really touches on more subjective matters, such as having a full and balanced body of work, as well as a strong voice, a bit of a controversial subject as we spoke about on our final episode of last season. I don't want to get into this whole kind of varied style debate here, but I think this can be really covered adequately if you just take the first step seriously, which is to locate agencies that have the best fit. Now, the second part of the series is focused more on kind of how to present yourself online. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of kind of things to consider here. But the points he makes are really kind of valid, especially just kind of keeping things kind of simple and clear. And a lot of this kind of might seem obvious, but yes, there's a lot of kind of sites that we look at where this kind of isn't done. But for me, the thing that I do when we get a submission, the first thing I like to do is click on an Instagram link. And sometimes if I'm in a huge rush, if I don't see an Instagram link either kind of in the signature or just kind of highlighting the body of the email, I might just kind of flag it to come back later because it's going to take me too long to actually copy and paste or kind of click somewhere else.
Crazy.
I rarely go to personal websites anymore. I don't know. I mean, most of the time, personal sites are just way too outdated. I mean, nobody updates kind of their sites as much. And Instagram is just so much more current. I want to see what an artist is working on, how often they're working, if they have a following, or if they're a kind of a diamond in the rough. And Instagram can tell us a lot of these things very kind of quickly. However, I'm also kind of finding that personal sites are making a bit of a comeback in the age of the algorithm. So I think that some of the points made here are valid, especially in flagging all the existing platforms that now exist, whether it's kind of Behance, which is, you know, I think Adobe has a new thing called Portfolio that kind of all kind of syncs together, Wix, Squarespace, I mean, a million different things. So yeah, I think, you know, the process is really easy. It allows you to really kind of showcase your work in many more formats and sizes, which is definitely a drawback in Instagram. I mean, Instagram, you can really only put your work up in a few kind of different ways, and seeing everything kind of cropped as well, it does make things kind of difficult, but there are some great advantages, and they highlight some folio examples in the site, in the article as well, which is great. The one thing that he highlights that I would kind of specifically kind of draw out is this whole idea of a visual summary of your body of work on the front page. And I think that's a lot of kind of what I want to see, and that oftentimes when I'm giving advice on folios, that's kind of what I say, that I just want to kind of go to the site and get a really kind of full overview of kind of what everything looks like and kind of who you are. And I literally just had
this conversation about 30 minutes ago with an artist. That is such weird timing.
Did you, I mean, in were you kind of taking the same point, or were you kind of having a counterpoint? Yeah,
like giving them feedback on their new website, which looks fantastic, but that it was missing, it was all divided into sections and it was missing an initial kind of landing where you got like a good snapshot overview of everything. And I was saying, like, if I were wanting to approach you for work, I think, you know, you would go to the website, you'd land on this page, have a scroll through, and not actually go to the other sections. I would just assume that what I landed on was going to give me a representation of everything, you know? And that wasn't the case. And there was some really strong work in the other sections. So I was like, you should absolutely have a landing page with thumbnails of different things. And if people want to investigate further, they can. But don't restrict them to that.
It's so interesting. I think because, oh God, I can't believe I just said that again, but it is so interesting.
The new, I can.
The new name of the podcast. I think that it's one of those things where you have to kind of show your work a lot we always talk about kind of, you know, user research and kind of, you know, all this kind of stuff, but it's so true. Like once you actually start kind of sitting in front of people physically to kind of see how they kind of look through your folio, either online or in person, it gives you so much of a better idea of what you kind of need to do. And
yeah,
I think
because you're too close to your work, you can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Completely. But also exactly. But I remember earlier when I was a graphic designer and I had my kind of printed folio and I would kind of go around to show it. It was like you sat down in front of an art director and they would just flick through it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'd be like, what? How do they actually kind of look through that? I would feel really bad about it. But that's kind of what I do now in a way, because I look at so many folios and it's kind of like, well, I can get that really kind of good sense. I do that kind of first quick pass and then I kind of go over it. And then it's kind of like a filtering process. And I realize a lot of the same thing does kind of happen.
You know what you're looking for now.
Oh, exactly. But the same thing happens online as well. It's like there really kind of is no different. Just because things are digital, I think people still move in the same way. They want to kind of filter that visual information first. They want to kind of go from the
big bits. Jeremy, it's just like Tinder. You just flick through quickly. You know what you're looking for.
You're going to have to educate me on this. This is not something that I know anything about. Are you talking about fire building? We'll have to come back to this.
I'll keep that secret, Jeremy. Don't worry.
Look, Lara, I really would like to hear more from you about this just in general, because you've been front and center on many new signings and seen pretty much all the thousands of submissions that have come in through over the years. The author of this piece acknowledges that there's still more to come kind of in this series. So, you know, obviously they haven't covered everything, but I'm curious to hear from you. If you had to boil down your own advice to one thing that artists can do to bolster their chance of getting representation, what would it be?
Ooh, starting off with a small question, Jeremy. No, I mean, I love seeing how different artists represent themselves. You know, the many submissions that we receive at Jackie Winter are really, truly one of the highlights of doing that work, you know, like getting to see so many budding artists carving paths for themselves in such different ways. I find it so interesting to hear that you rarely visit personal websites anymore, because I certainly do. I always look at an artist's Instagram page as well, or actually not even always, but I really value the extra depth of information that you get on a website. And I think it's a really good insight into how an artist presents themselves. And I think you're right that they often can be pretty out of date, but the best artists do keep them updated. And I value that. You know, I guess an artist might post, you know, anything and everything to Instagram, which is great. And I love to see that. But on the website, you get to see the projects that they're most proud of. And to me, that's really interesting too. And I also like to see how they write about themselves and what sort of information they provide. And anyway, I think that the fact that we differ so much here is exactly why I kind of hate answering these questions of like, how do I get an agent, or what should my folio look like? Because it's just so subjective. And I personally think like an artist for multiple reasons should have both a website and an Instagram. You might not. And I worry about someone taking anyone's advice as gospel just because we work in the industry, you know, because that advice is going to change enormously depending on who you ask or what conference you're at or what podcast you're listening to or Medium article you're reading. So I guess whilst I think a lot of the general advice in this article is really, really good, for example, you know, doing your research on agencies to see if you're a good fit, making sure your folio is clear and easy to navigate, etc., what I'm never as much of a fan of is the really specific rules. And there's some kind of doled out here and more in the second part, things like, you know, use a white background in your folio. And like, I agree that if you're not good at design or not going to hire someone good, then yeah, obviously like keeping it as simple as possible is absolutely best. But some of my favorite folios of all time are ones that have really highlighted the kind of unique and bizarre personalities and work of that particular artist. Like I think, for example, of like Becky Orpin's recent website revamp that she did with design studio Autoland, or there's one from Mariano Pasquale that I sent to you guys a while ago, whose folio itself is just such a cool art piece. And I think, yeah, you know, if in doubt, go simple, and there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, and of course, there's many a very simple folio that I absolutely love that lets the work truly speak for itself, and where any other option would have been crap. And it's absolutely better than creating something overly complex that's poorly executed. But I would say that if you feel it's right to do something different, something a bit out there, to not let our advice or anyone else's stop you. I think if everyone did their folios in the same way, life would be very boring. And we need simple and we also need crazy. And I think it's up to each artist to decide what's going to work for their art and their career. And I think there's merit in both. But back to your actual question, my advice is nothing revolutionary, but it is practical, I guess. And that's just to make a lot of work. I think if you want representation, if you want to be the best or one of the best, if you want to be relevant commercially and you want people to engage with your work, make a lot of it. You will sharpen your strengths and create more opportunities for people to resonate with your work and broaden your market. If you are consistently pushing your practice, you will inevitably get better. And as you get better, you will generate more work and the right agency will be lucky to have you. You know, I think too many people start doing illustration and right away ask questions about how to get representation, how to get the biggest clients, how to get millions of Insta followers. And I'm not saying it's not important to do future planning or to be active in shaping your path. Of course it is. But most of these questions kind of answer themselves if you keep pushing yourself and improving your work. I mean, that's my two cents anyway. And I have to say as well, like, I'm really looking forward to the third and fourth parts of this series. And I do really wish they were live already, because it's there that Tom plans to talk about a bit more about how to present yourself and prove that you're ready to take on professional work, which I think is going to be really interesting. And perhaps we should dip back into it, Jeremy, on this podcast when those parts are out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are some really good points. And of course, yeah, this is a huge, huge subject. And I think the whole idea of agents only kind of being, well, I mean, my attitude is that agents are kind of only one kind of small part of a bigger kind of toolbox that you have. I think
absolutely,
it's kind of, you know, it's not the kind of be all and end all, and you don't have just kind of one opportunity to kind of, you know, have your audition and then kind of that's it. There are many artists that we represent who have submitted over a number of years and continue to refine their practice. And I think when we kind of see something, I'll always kind of open a dialogue and try to kind of coach people around. But also, you know, there's kind of, just because you kind of also have kind of one style at the moment, you know, that style can kind of completely evolve. And it has a whole kind of life cycle, and how you approach things is always going to be kind of changing. And I think the whole idea that I look at something when someone approaches us, it's like they're approaching us for kind of where they are kind of at that stage kind of right now. And it's not kind of a forever thing. So I kind of feel that, you know, even though if you don't get a kind of response, or that should never kind of discourage you from kind of continuing kind of to submit and continue kind of pursuing your craft, because what an agency kind of tells you is completely kind of subjective to just where they are at kind of that moment, and is not a real kind of reflection.
And those agents and whatever, and even like the people there change, the market changes. So yeah, that response is very much of that moment. Again, the same person I was talking about before that I had a really interesting conversation with like half an hour ago, it was really interesting talking to him, because what I was asking about was like, okay, why do you want an agent? Like, why do you think that now is the time? And it was really interesting to hear how different his answers were to some artists that I speak to. And I think that talking to this person, they really did seem actually ready for representation, and looking at their work and looking at their career progression, they kind of really seem like to be in the right place. But it's really important to figure that out, because as we talk about all the time, this sort of agent artist relationship is, or at least should be, a really sort of two-way mutually beneficial thing. And that only happens when you have an artist who's ready and an agent who is right for that artist. So it's important to consider all of those things first.
Lots to say on this. Probably not going to be the last time we talk about it, but Laura, thank you
Absolutely
for your feedback.
Not.
And we will move on from there. And it is time for, in our new slim down format, the second and final link of the week. Once you get an agent, you're going to hear probably some of these phrases. Oh, sorry. No, that wasn't a good segue.
Oh, unlike all your other really great segues, Jeremy.
My segues are fucking fantastic.
Look, I'm going to get into it. I am kicking the season off with something a little bit clickbaity, but useful. This article comes to us from Adobe's 99U blog, and it's titled, "Watch out for these phrases designed to trap freelancers." It also has a lovely header illustration by Giacomo Bagnara, which I really liked. Anyway, basically 99U asked a range of creatives to kind of call out some of the red flags that they've learned to watch out for during their careers. And we all know the ones, we all get them. Things like, you know, this is an opportunity to be seen by a great audience, or, oh no, it shouldn't take you very long. And these phrases are pretty manipulative, often due to ignorance, not malice, but they can be dangerous. And every creative can tell stories of when they've made the mistake of missing certain red flag phrases, putting them in kind of nightmare projects or battles with tough clients. And I think regardless of experience level, when you're working solo as a freelancer, it can be really hard to assess what's valid and what's not, or even just to know how to respond. So I liked this article. And of the 8 phrases they highlight here, there are a couple I would like to chat about a bit more and expand on. So the first one comes from Mac Primo, who is a fascinating American artist with an incredible breadth of practice. The phrase that he highlights is, "We don't have a budget for this one, but we will for the next." And he writes, and I quote, "That phrase is my number one of all red flags. It admits that the work is worth more than is being offered for it and says that acknowledgement will come later if you prove yourself this time. It's like going into a pizza place, ordering a slice, taking a bite and saying, no, it's not what I hoped, and walking out of the store. It doesn't work that way. It leverages the baked-in inequality that exists in the freelance world. It's taking advantage by using the carrot of opportunity while ignoring the reality of straight-up ethical business. Every single person in the freelance sphere has dealt with this. And even if you know better, you still look at the big picture of the potential project and say, yeah, but this time, because the definition of insanity and the definition of freelancing are the same thing. You do the same thing over and over again, and you expect a different result. Don't expect that promise to come back to you, because it won't. I don't know anyone who has had a return client who has said, okay, like we said, we didn't have a budget for the last one, but here's more money. Generally, things end how they start." And now what I would add to this is that I agree with everything Max says, but I think sometimes there is one way to make this kind of approach work. And what I've done in the past, only when absolutely necessary, is I've agreed with the client on exactly what that future budget would be, and then had them sign an agreement that if the next project doesn't go ahead, then they still have to pay a certain percentage of that fee. For example, it might be like 25% or 50%. And, you know, this still isn't ideal, of course, but if you really need the work or really want the project, which I always try to acknowledge when we talk about this stuff, because I think in everything that we talk about, it's easy enough for us to say, just walk away if the conditions aren't perfect. But that's just not a reality for a lot of people. And I think this can be a kind of way of guaranteeing that regardless of what happens, you will be covered financially. And you have to be careful to work out what sort of numbers are going to cover you. But this approach can at least kind of help distinguish the very few clients who are serious about coming back with more budget and those that aren't. And I think more often than not, they'll say no, in which case you can tell that they weren't being truthful in the first place. But I have had real instances where the client has happily agreed to this system, and the next project has either gone ahead at this higher budget or they've paid the kill fee. So the second one I want to highlight is from Jing Wei, who is an illustrator, part of the Pencil Factory in Brooklyn. And her highlighted phrase is, "We are reviewing proposals before choosing an artist. Would you provide a few concepts?" And she writes, again, I quote, "I've seen many emails that sneak in language that basically translates to a request for spec work. There is an intentional ambiguity on the topic of payment, which bothers me to no end. Clients who ask for sample sketches usually rely on the fact that the artist either doesn't know any better or wants the job badly enough to do the work. On top of that, there's the threat of competition from other artists, which makes some people think this is the norm, or if they don't participate, they could automatically lose the job. In the early years of freelancing, there was definitely times when I gave clients the benefit of the doubt and provided sample illustrations. It's easy to be wooed by the prospect of getting a big project to the point where you may be willing to take the gamble. However, you deserve to be paid for the time you're putting in, regardless of whether or not your work is ultimately used. It never hurts to ask for what you believe is fair. If they say no, you're probably dodging a bullet." End quote. Now, this one is, of course, a big problem that we and I guess every freelancer would come up against often. And we've talked about spec work before, but I think it's kind of key to highlight the often subtle ways that clients try to get artists to do this. And, you know, there are very few industries where one would expect new work to be created for free before making a decision. And in reality, if your folio is strong, then that should be sample enough. And I guess my suggestion is that when someone asks for concepts or a sample, suggest a fee to cover the time and agree on exactly what that fee covers. Maybe it's, you know, 2 rough sketches based off the provided brief, no rounds of revision, whatever it is that works for you. And be sure to agree on what the full fee would be if the project were to go ahead, because there's no point doing a sample to win a job only to find out that the final budget isn't even going to cover you. And that stands for timings too, you know, because when will they make a decision? When will the full project begin and end, et cetera? One thing to note is I also usually offer to absorb that sample fee into the total project budget if the work goes ahead. So the sample fee acts again as a kill fee in a way. So for example, say you agree to $1,500 for the sample and a total budget of $10,000 for the full scope of work. If that project goes ahead, then that $10,000 would include the fee for the sample. And if not, then the client needs to just pay you the $1,500. And phrasing things this way can kind of help make clients feel like you're being flexible, even though in reality, the costs are kind of the same. And the other thing is to confirm with them that the sample piece is exactly that, just an initial sample, not a final piece. So the fee doesn't include rights to usage. And that, of course, you know, with the ability to actually work closely with the client and incorporate their feedback, you would be able to craft something even stronger. And that might seem obvious to you, but it's often not. Clients just assume that if you're given the brief, you'll be able to churn out the perfect thing that, you know, they're seeing in their mind, but it's impossible to mind read like that. And to create really good work, you have to work collaboratively. Sometimes just explaining that to them can help them see things differently. I also won't say that there's never a reason to do spec work, because I definitely acknowledge that there are cases in which it might be necessary. For example, if you're trying to get work in a totally different style to what's in your folio. But for the very large majority of cases, you should not be doing free samples. They should always be paid, and you should both always know exactly what that payment covers. And for many artists, even paid samples aren't feasible. So if that's you, then develop a script that you can use to explain to clients why you aren't able to take part in this sort of work, and perhaps offer instead to put together like a sample of existing references of your work that kind of help to show that you're the right fit. Anyway, those are the two that really stuck out to me. Jeremy, I would love to hear if anything in this list really like resonated with you, or if there was anything you didn't agree with.
It was a very good piece written by Emily Ludoff as well, the interviewer. She actually wrote a piece on Jackie Winter Gardens on 99U the other month. So Emily, if you're listening to this, thank you very much. And we really enjoyed this. I do think it would have been nice just to see a bit more actual like ways to kind of counter this, kind of as you said. Yeah. I think as agents, like one of our biggest things that we do is like the very complex negotiation that you kind of just mentioned now. And I kind of think that even though that approach is great, it does take a certain amount of like you've had to do it kind of a few times to kind of get that muscle memory of how to, you know, navigate
and it takes
all those
a lot
kind
of
things that kind of come up. It does. And again, a lot of these things do come up kind of from ignorance. And it's really hard, because sometimes I find that we're in our own position in this kind of way, like when we're asking our own artists to kind of help out for our own marketing purposes. And so I'm often kind of thinking about like, oh, this is like, you know, where am I kind of being a bad client here? Like the way that I'm
where are your blind spots?
Exactly. So it's always interesting to kind of read about these things. I think that if there's no kind of particular one that kind of resonated with me in particular. I think there are kind of ways to address all these things though. I think especially, you know, there's a big kind of gray area in kind of all those things. Like, so when someone says kind of, it really shouldn't take too long, I mean, that's a really good opportunity for you to kind of educate somebody in terms of what your process is. And I kind of think that, you know, that could be part of how you deal with your own marketing. Like if you have a website, you know, showing your process as well. So if you can front load some of these things, like with how you market yourself and how you communicate, you can turn these questions into opportunities to educate. You know, that's why something kind of like use it or lose it, where, you know, if someone kind of comes up with something, you can kind of send this back and kind of have a bigger conversation. So I kind of think, you know, or even something like, will you work in trade? It's like, we talked about that on the Paula Scher quote that we did from the AIGA blog the other month, but sometimes there's nothing wrong with doing work in trade. Like what if that trade is, you know, significant equity, or, you know, a product that you really want, or some kind of marketing opportunity that is kind of genuine. So yeah, there are a lot of kind of things there. I think the idea, you know, that Jing kind of said about, we're reviewing proposals before choosing an artist. Like, yes, this is potentially a very dangerous thing, but it's also a really good opportunity to find out more about the project, like, you know, to be engaged in a dialogue, because I think people are just so averse to any kind of risk these days. So I do understand the, like, why kind of people are wanting to do that. And it's especially hard in bigger organizations when nobody really wants to make a decision, and there's so many kind of decision makers kind of in the process. And so they want to kind of cut down that risk as much as possible. Sometimes they want to see, we always kind of joke, they want to kind of see the finished art before it's actually kind of done. And there's so many different kind of metaphors to other professions that you could actually kind of put and kind of use. But yeah, the fact is that these are opportunities you could kind of then have this conversation and kind of find out, well, okay, if you're reviewing concepts, like what are you awarding the job on? Like, are you awarding it based on cost? Are you awarding it based on creativity? And then you can kind of figure out what kind of leverage you have there as well. You know, sometimes they might be asking you for a concept, but you can get a good feeling that you know they're not going to be going with anyone else, or you know they really kind of want to go with you. So there's lots of different kind of things that kind of can come to the mix here. And the more jobs that you kind of talk about and the more things that you do, the better that you're going to be at negotiating these things. I think, though,
I completely agree.
If I had to add kind of one phrase to this, I think the phrase would be, I don't know how I'd actually pronounce it, but it would be, this is the only contract we have, or there's no room for changes in this contract. Yeah. And I kind of think that,
Why do we need to work with a contract? Do we really need a contract? I mean, oof.
And this is, again, another area where when you're working in really big organizations, like this happens in publishing, like so much, where it's like their whole, you know, job is just churning out a number of kind of books every kind of year, hoping that one will kind of hit the jackpot there. And they don't want to kind of deal with managing and kind of tweaking individual contracts that could kind of leave them kind of liable. But I know from our own experience that when a client really, really wants to work with you, they will do what it takes to change, you know, a contract. Most of these places, especially big clients, have huge legal teams as well. And yeah, of course, like their legal team is there to kind of completely protect them and completely advantage the client. But there is always room for negotiation. And I kind of think it not just kind of contracts, but any single aspect, whether it's kind of timing, creative, budget, legals, there is always room for movement. So I kind of think, again, this is kind of one of the things that we're very skillful at as kind of agents here. But I kind of think it's important to kind of know that and really kind of feel that as a freelancer, because it can be very intimidating when you're just doing this kind of, when you're starting out, or if the job is kind of big and you don't want to kind of take those risks. But yeah, I guess that's totally what I'm here to say, is that, you know, there's always that room.
A lot of good stuff there, Jeremy. I think what I'd add as well is that one thing that gets me makes me a bit uncomfortable about these articles, and this one included, even though it was a great article, is that they start out always with this us versus them kind of attitude of this, like, these manipulative, evil clients, here's how to tackle them, here's what to look out for, you know? And I think what everyone seems to forget, and you see this everywhere, you see this in all sort of advice websites for creatives, and I think it's so easy to forget or not realize that, as you said, most of this, not always, but most of it comes out of ignorance, not out of someone trying to, like, do you dirty, you know? And that education is so crucial, and often it actually just takes not a lot of it, you know, to really turn it around. And that helps you and every other artist they kind of work with from there on in. And like the amount, I can't tell you the amount of clients I've worked with who have demanded certain things or assumed certain things because they don't know any different. And we say this all the time, but it is your job as the creative being, you know, engaged to educate that client. It's your job to know how it works and to help guide them through it. And that, as you said, Jeremy, those are all opportunities to create more work. The only other, the things I would add to this list, if I was going to add something, was a client not really having a brief and who says that they're happy for you to do whatever you want. This is one that, again, comes out of often like really good intentions on the client's side. They love your work and they think that, yeah, of course, they're going to do an awesome job. But it should set off some alarm bells, and you really should kind of do what you can to sort of push back against this. Cause I have sort of learned the hard way that 99.99% of the time, a client who says that they're happy for the artist to do whatever they want, it's sort of not actually the case, whether they know it or not. And absolutely, what they really mean is, yeah, that they don't actually know how to express what they want, but everyone likes and dislikes things. So there's really very little chance in hell that they would be actually happy with any of the millions of potential paths that you could go down. And without a clear vision, they're likely to be disappointed in what you deliver. So I think, you know, generally, as soon as you start delivering work, they'll suddenly know what they want or don't want. You'll create something and they'll tell you, like, no, it needs to be bluer or rounder or have more cats or whatever. Because it's only once they see something in front of them that they can articulate what they like and dislike. And those projects are almost always a giant waste of time. So, you know, in how do you deal with that? I think it's, you know, it's not about walking away. It's about pushing for a brief. It's about feeling confident in explaining to the client why you need one, that you know from experience that the more details that they give you about the project and their vision, that the better you can cater to their needs and help them by guiding them through questions that will sort of help you figure out what they're after. You know, you can direct them to your folio and ask them to pick references and tell you what they like and don't like about those pieces, and ask them more about the purpose of the work and the audience. And, you know, if there really does need to be some kind of broader exploration and they can't give you a firm direction until that happens and you really want the project, then I guess, at least make sure that they can confirm things like specs and usage. So you have a starting point and, of course, kind of agree on a big budget to cover all that extra exploration time and be very clear and strict with them about rounds of revision so that they know from the outset what kind of changes they could make. And that alone can often push a client to be much more decisive, just knowing what that process is going to be. And if a client can't do any of that or understand, you know, why it's important, then yeah, probably run in the other direction.
Good advice indeed. Anyway, Laura, thank you very much for bringing this to the table. And I think we'll wrap up from here. Now, in a little bit of an experiment for a new segment that we're doing, as we do with our actual in-person Open Tabs events, we're just kind of going through some of the other tabs that are kind of been in our browser throughout the week, a bit more of whether it's kind of a personal or less kind of creative stance. So yeah, for me, I'm just going to pick some three here that have been meaning to get to. The first one is a URL called dazzle.studio for the studio called appropriately named Dazzle. And I mean, talking about kind of different kind of folio sites, I mean, this is a bigger kind of studio. It is just the most fun experience I've had kind of working or just kind of browsing through work in a while. They've done a lot of amazingly kind of graphic work, including they did the design for Harry's.
It's fun. Yeah, I'm on it right now.
That Craig and Carl did some work for. So exciting. Love that. I've also got some more. I usually keep a lot of music kind of stuff in my kind of open tabs because if there's kind of videos or things that I have to listen to, those usually kind of hang along the most. And there was a piece on Rolling Stone. I think it is in celebration of Weezer's kind of Blue album from 1994. And I don't know when this was kind of put out.
Weezer, Jeremy.
This was a seminal album. And yeah, it just kind of goes, it's a really, really long piece. And it has some links to some YouTube clips of some really kind of deep cuts and a bit more kind of embarrassed. Not that embarrassing, but I don't know why. Yes, this is, I'm going to admit this. I like the band Sublime. I just do. I always have.
I also like the band Sublime, Jeremy. I don't agree with you on Weezer or vests, but I like Sublime.
This is a piece from the AV Club saying called Sublime's legacy is more complicated than the bros and the haters would have you think. So it's a really kind of a thoughtful piece that kind of, I think, gives me a bit more kind of credence for my love of the band Sublime. And those are my kind of three open tabs for the week. Laura, what's in your browser?
Oh, God. I have got... Oh, God, less intelligent things than you. But what have I got? So I cooked for my family here in Mexico the other week, which is absolutely terrifying because Mexican food is outrageously good and they're all great cooks. And luckily it went down really well. But I went back to an old fave on the New York Times cooking site, which is Rishia Zimmern's Chicken with Shallots. And it's just like the bloody yummiest. And this is the recipe that made me pay for my New York Times cooking subscription because I need to be able to return to it. I suppose I could actually just like copy and paste it somewhere, but no, I'm going to support the New York Times. And it's so delicious and so yummy and seems impressive, even though it doesn't take a lot of effort. The other thing I've had open this week, which I haven't read yet because I've been busy, you know, traipsing around Mexico, but is Ida Butros's statement, the ABC chair, her statement in response to the federal police raids at the ABC. And obviously been reading a lot about that, very concerning, but there were some very positive reactions to her statement. So I'm looking forward to reading that in full. And then the other thing that I had open this week, and I have to say a big thank you to our artist, Adriana Picker, because she was in Mexico recently and I asked her for some tips and holy shit, did she deliver. She had asked like a bunch of her friends for tips, and then she's compiled them all into like this masterless PDF, and it is 45 pages worth of tips for Mexico City. So I am very slowly working my way through some of these, but so far it's been very good.
Amazing. Before we leave for the week, it's time for our favorite segment, Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the stunning off of our chest. Lara, what do you got for us this week?
I've got a big thumbs up this week, and we're going back to food here because it's really all I'm thinking about at the moment. And my thumbs up is for escamoles, which are ant larvae. Yum. They were eaten as a delicacy by the Aztecs, and you can find them all over Mexico today in a variety of dishes, along with many other bugs. Jeremy, you'd love it, I'm sure. And yeah, no. Escamoles kind of look like pine nuts, but they're kind of usually fried with like butter and spices, and I've been eating them a fair bit. But my favorite this week was on top of some sopes with refried beans and bone marrow, and I am drooling now again just thinking about it. Jeremy, what is your thumbs up, thumbs down, shocker.
Well, I got a shocker this week, a blatant kind of self-plug for our newest puzzle release, which is the 540 Puzzles Sphere. So for those of you who don't know, with one of our artists, Clemens Habeck, we have been kind of producing these color puzzles for almost like 4 or 5 years now. And yeah, they're
Jesus,
kind of stuck
it has
there.
Not been 4 or 5 years.
It's been a long time. There are kind of 8 or 9 different variations now, and this is our first foray into a 3D puzzle. This is a sphere, like kind of, it's like 22 centimeters kind of in circumference, and it's really, really cool. I really love it. It's so much fun making kind of real things and then kind of, you know, selling them. And yeah, I think this is just my favorite one that we've done. So
I got
to
see it before I left for Mexico, and it is damn cool. It's awesome.
Anyway, that is at puzzle.lamingtondrive.com. We've also got Jackie Winter Artist Edition puzzles as well at puzzle.jackiewinter.com if you are up for a puzzle. And that is it for this week. I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Laura Chan Baker. And this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more of the podcast, archives of all of our shows and the links we've covered can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And to receive our newsletter every week, you can sign up at jwg.biz/newslettering. That contains all the links we talk about in the show, as well as other Jackie Winter related content. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the sea. And you can email us for anything at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. We will catch you next week. Bye bye. So for us, for example, we don't speak Japanese. We don't have office there or no, excuse me, fucking Christ, a bit rusty after 5 weeks off the old blower, hey?
The old blower.
The same way.
Hey, I'm good. Pick yourself, mate.